Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. My guest this week is Bethany Heck. She is currently a creative lead for Microsoft's Power BI team. Her work has been featured in New York Magazine, The New Yorker, Wired, Smashing Magazine, Uppercase Magazine, and several other international publications. In addition to that, she runs Ephus League, an online shop dedicated to the fringes of baseball, and freelances under her company, Heck House. Bethany and I talk about growing up the child of a design professor, her love of baseball, the difference between being a designer and being a creative director, and much more. All right, well then we'll just dive right into it.
Okay.
All right. Bethany, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
So, let's just start off with where you grew up.
I grew up in Auburn, Alabama, which is mostly known for its sports teams. And
War Eagle.
War Eagle, and is right on the edge of Alabama and Georgia.
Okay. So did, because, and we'll get into this in a second, I know your dad was a professor there. Were you kind of born and raised there, or was did you move there when you were little?
I was born there and lived there until I moved off for grad school and jobs.
Gotcha. So since you, so let's touch on your lineage of graphic design and get the parental burden out of the way, which the I'm sure he'll love when he hears that.
The Heck dynasty of graphic design.
Yes.
So my dad got his degree from ETSU, which is in Tennessee, which is where he and both he and my mom grew up. And they moved to, they lived in South Carolina for a while, and then he moved to Auburn to start teaching there in the graphic design program. And I came along and I taught myself Photoshop when I was in junior high, but never really thought much of graphic. I don't think I really understood what graphic design was as a profession until I got, you know, very close to college and into college when I started looking at web design as like a possible career option. And I actually started off college in horticulture because I needed a scholarship, and they had lots of scholarships. So I
was this on your dad's advice? Like he got an inside scoop from somebody?
Well, there was somebody at our church who sort of ran the scholarships for that department. And basically, if there was any, and he homeschooled his kids, I was homeschooled. So you know, anybody who was like remotely a decent student, he was, you know, recruiting hard for come to Auburn, do horticulture, you know, you can take other classes instead of horticulture, but, you know, at least spend your first 2 years in horticulture and see if you like it. And, you know, we'll take care of you. So that's basically what I did. And then I figured out very quickly that horticulture was not what I wanted to do.
Didn't have a green thumb, huh?
No, and I have vampiric skin. Just not so good at the whole being outside thing. So
like most graphic designers.
Yeah. So begged Dad to let me try out in the graphic design department, and he was very against it because
he teaches in the graphic design department.
Yes, he knows what it, you know, he knew better than anybody what, you know, what the career path could be like, the possible pratfalls. And because I was a good student, he wanted me to try something else. But I was set on it and twisted his arm enough until finally got him to concede and give his blessing to try to get into the program.
Did you try to avoid his classes as much as possible? Just because he was your dad?
I had to for the first several years. So like any of the classes that would have determined whether or not I made it in the program, I could not have him. And I don't think I didn't have him until my senior year, I think, for a graphic design 2 class. And so, yeah, they were that was an interesting kind of thing because there were certain like student awards that I wasn't really eligible for because of my relationship with him and everything else. So I definitely felt like some of the students treated, like once they found out that I was a professor's daughter, they treated me a little bit like an ark for a little while. Like,
you're going to tell on us.
Ooh, let's be careful around her. So I had to, you know, work kind of hard to build friendships.
And meanwhile, you're trying to get away with the same crap they are, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I was that those classes were the first time I was using like InDesign and Illustrator all that much. So I was learning just as much more than any of them were.
Sure. So you get through your undergrad, avoiding your dad as much as possible. And then you went to grad school, right?
I spent one semester at grad school at MICA. And then their MFA program, and it just wasn't a good fit. That was a really hard thing. Like, I didn't, that program was very highly ranked, and so mm-hmm. I didn't even know if I was going to get in. And so to get in and then go and then like have, like, it's expensive, it's far, you know, you're moving away from home, and then realizing like, this is just, this something about this isn't right.
Well, but you also go from being born and raised and, you know, Auburn's not exactly a big town. No. I mean, it's grown now where it's, you know, Opelika, Auburn. But it's still not a big town by any means. So you go from that up to MICA, which is a little more metropolitan.
Yeah, Baltimore was the obviously my first experience living in a city, and it was definitely different from what I had grown up with. But I've enjoyed living in cities since, don't want to put too much of it on like, oh, I didn't like Baltimore. I didn't like Baltimore, but I think it had more to do with the grad school than anything else.
So you just didn't enjoy grad school and.
I felt, it was just a big change, like going from a public university, you know, academic setting to a art school, private, you know, setting for mm-hmm. my learning was a big shift. And, I don't know if there's anything that I could have done beforehand that would have prepared me for it, but I didn't feel like I was growing enough. I didn't feel like I felt more constrained there, which was weird because it's like, I'm in art school and I've got classmates who are doing like naked selfies for projects, and I feel like I'm not being, you know,
a project?
That's really.
I'm sorry, I'm an art major, but
they did, you know. They sold it.
Okay.
But, you know, I guess you gotta have the right. I was not a good enough salesman to kind of get away with doing what I want. So I think a lot of that kind of stuff is sort of having the swagger to kind of like,
and probably didn't want to get. Take naked selfies either.
Yes. Well, yeah, naked selfies is not a genre that I think I'm going to be participating in. But I think that the kids who, the people who did best in art school, like have a certain like confidence and, you know, just kind of the audacity to dream up something that they want to do and figure out how to pitch it and get it. And I was just not used to needing that kind of, needing to have that kind of interaction to be, you know, successful as a student. So I got through it and got a job working at a web design agency and mm-hmm. left, and I've never second guessed that decision. So it was a good learning experience.
Gotcha.
And it got me, you know, out of Alabama, which is not a small thing. You know, if I hadn't have done that, maybe I never would have left, you know.
I've been sucked back here a couple times. So. But, so you get out of the grad program, you're going to work for this web design firm. You know, how did you figure out that was the right fit for you in the path? I mean, I know you studied it in school, so obviously, you know, you had an interest in it, but.
Yeah, I'd always been more, even though Auburn's like a very traditional print based graphic design program, I had always had more of an interest in web design. I liked doing the coding aspect of it. I liked that it, you know, it was always changing and just kind of the immediacy and of the craft of it.
Sure.
And, you know, the ability to share with anybody, like there are all these aspects of it that I really enjoyed. And then from like a career standpoint, like it's, you know, the compensation tends to be better. There are things like that too. And there's right. just like, there's certain parts of the mental process or like you're designing a website where somebody, it's very rare that you have somebody come to you and ask for a website and just be like, I don't know, just make something cool. Which I don't actually do very well with. Like, I like to be like, here's the copy that I have and here's the pictures that I have and here's what I'm trying to say. Cause so can you help me say that in the best way? So
I'm like, the same way. Give me the parameters, give me the box that you need to be in and yes. let me figure out how to piece everything together.
Yeah.
In that puzzle.
Yeah. So I like having a box. So web design, you know, is good about, you know, you kind of are required to have that. To be in that, to, you know, come to an agency asking for that sure. sort of thing. So, that's what got me started with that. And then, so I was doing, working in various places doing web design for several years, after leaving grad school. And that was a great learning experience for me because just getting to stay on top of that technology and that industry, and then also, like that, you know, got lucky enough to have positions that gave me enough free time to where I could still pursue some of my side projects and things like that, that were more, you know, graphic design, print based stuff. So just kind of having my toes in both mediums.
Sure. So, you know, moving forward, how did you end up out in Seattle?
I came here to follow the boss that I had while I was at IBM, who was a guy named Russell Wilson, funny enough. Mm-hmm. Russell Wilson, Seattle. That's endless jokes for football fans. So I had a good working relationship with him. Like, he, you know, felt like he trusted me. He gave me opportunities to lead teams at IBM and kind of take the next step forward in my career. And then the opportunity at Microsoft was basically being the creative director for an entire product. Mm-hmm. And that was really interesting to me. The idea of getting to, like, everything I'd heard about Seattle had been good. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I took the leap of, you know, let's try out product design and let's see Seattle and work for a company like Microsoft, which isn't necessarily a place where I ever thought I'd be working, but it's been really good so far.
You weren't necessarily looking for a big corporate structure, but somehow found yourself in it.
Yes.
So, you know, your career trajectory, you go from, you know, just being a web designer up through art director to creative director over an entire product line. How did that transition affect you and the process that you go through of designing? Because if you're acting as CD at Microsoft, I imagine day in and day out, you're not doing a ton of design. You're more overseeing people and how you do that. That's kind of, I forgot who said it, but somebody said, you know, the better that you get at your job, the less you do your job.
Yes, that's definitely true. And I've seen that with other people on our team at Microsoft too. Like, there's always this kind of like struggle with people who are really talented individual contributors who want to, you know, sometimes they get tired of it or sometimes they want to like move more into that mentorship, like director type role, but they mm-hmm. also still want to get their fingers dirty with things. So it's hard to find the right balance. For me, moving into that kind of role was one of the explicit reasons why I took the job, because I felt like I was getting burnout, you know, kind of being more on the production line and being expected to design things every day.
Sure.
And so just for everybody's different, you know, like some people just seem like they're endless, you know, wells of creative energy and they're just brimming with ideas and they've got to be designing all the time. And I'm more low energy. Like, my stuff kind of comes in bursts. So I felt like it was important for just my career moving forward that I get experience in more of this leadership overseeing role and mentoring younger designers. And like, I wanted to, cause those are some of the aspects that interested me about teaching, which is why mm-hmm. I went to grad school in the first place, is cause I wanted to get an MFA so I could teach. Mm-hmm. So moving into this kind of role that I have at Microsoft felt like the way that I could fulfill all those desires, but still get to design some myself, you know, have the advantages of getting to learn in this big corporate environment. It's a very diverse workspace. There's a lot of advantages to working in that kind of environment. So yeah, a lot of my day to day is looking at red lines for, you know, designs before they go out, establishing standards about what certain parts of our product look like. This is how Power BI looks and feels. This, mm-hmm. you know, what it should be communicating to users, you know, telling people when they can and cannot use certain typefaces. And, you know, some of it might sound boring, but some of it I kind of like kind of the systems aspect of it. It's a different way to think at things. And then I also get to jump in and work directly on things whenever I want to. So if we're having a big redesign of one of our products, like sure. I get to drive that. So I kind of get to have my cake and eat it too. So it's a good situation.
Well, that works well. So, you know, how do you enjoy that mentoring and managing process?
Definitely. I'm a pretty heavy introvert. So mm-hmm. I didn't think that was something that I would enjoy when I was early on in my career. And it wasn't until I worked at IBM before I worked at Microsoft. And
sure.
part of my role there was finding other designers to join the team and build up the lab that we're working in. And mm-hmm. I really found that enjoyable, like just sort of emailing people out of the blue and saying, hey, do you want to move to Austin and come work at this cool thing with these cool people? Because I think your work's rad. And so getting to connect with people that way, even if they're not interested, just like getting to meet other designers and just trying to find, like, hunt for people on, you know, Dribbble and all these other platforms, looking for their people who you think might be the right fit.
Sure.
And going through that process of kind of like, you know, hunting people down and, you know, grabbing them and, you know, hopefully they come. And I've really liked that part of it. And then the mentoring part I love too, because, you know, when you do something like that, like mentoring and teaching is always a two-way street. Like when you do the teaching, you know, just to communicate something, you're having to reiterate it in your own mind. And then you learn mm-hmm. things from the people who you're mentoring because they're bringing their own perspectives. So that whole aspect of it, that's definitely the most fulfilling. The people, finding people to work with and getting to work with those people and getting to work with the really talented team that I'm working with now is by far the highlight of the job for me.
Yeah. Being able to assemble that team and find out what everybody's strengths and weaknesses are and how to utilize those is fun. Yeah. I mean, that's my role. That's kind of what I do too, is I'm the CD for, well, not entitled, but I'm the CD there. So it's finding and managing, you know, team members and kind of getting them to do things that they don't necessarily want to do, but yeah. I can see that they would be good at it, and you know, figuring out how to utilize that and then working with outside vendors and building all that stuff as well.
Yeah.
So since you're not getting, granted, you did say you get to jump in every once in a while and get your hands dirty, but since you don't get to do the day in, day out creative thing, is that kind of how EFAS League started? Taking a hard left there and transitioning into that.
The EFAS League was actually, it was my last project at Auburn.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So at Auburn, your last semester, you have a senior project. That's the thing that you focus on. You have to like make a pitch and say, I'm going to deliver X, Y, and Z by the end of the semester. And this is the brand that I'm working on, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I wanted to do something baseball related, because the Braves were really good at that time. And I was just hype about it. And I had done a baseball project earlier that year and it had a lot of fun. So I was like, this, I love the design history of baseball and I love baseball. So I should figure out something baseball related to do. Okay. So that's how the website got started. And I made, you know, like I hand sewed the first scorebook and, you know, made all these posters and t-shirts and things. And so I made it for that. And then afterwards I was like, well, maybe I could turn this into a real thing. So like I knew that I could release the website to the public, but I was interested in the merch and seeing if anybody would be interested in buying any of the things that I had made. So I reached out to a guy named Paul Lucas, who writes for ESPN, and he writes a blog called uniwatch.com. So he, and he focuses on sports uniforms. And he had a very clear appreciation for design as well. So I wanted to reach out to him and send him my stuff and see if he would respond, and because he seemed like kind of the ideal person who would be interested in sort of the old ephemera and the imagery and things that, that I was dealing with in the EFIS League. And so he responded and said, "Hey, this looks really interesting. Would you like, you know, I'll interview you for the site, and we can ask the readers what parts that, what things that you've made are interesting to you, are interesting to them." And so we did that, and I was, and he was like, and all these comments started coming in, and I started getting all these emails, and they were like, "You should make the scorebook that you did," which I was surprised by, because the scorebook was sort of something that I threw in at the last minute. Not that many.
It's always the thing that you don't expect.
I know, like, not. It's a very scorekeeping is a very small. Like, baseball is not the most popular sport in America anymore. And then scorekeeping is a very small niche. I don't know what percentage of fans keep score. It's a very small percentage.
Certainly not me. But then again, I'm a Cubs fan, so. Well. You know, that's just, you know, cruel and unusual punishment to do to yourself.
Yeah. but, I kept hearing back from all these people saying you need to make the scorebook. And then I started going around, and I took the scorebooks that I made for the school project and took them to all these print shops in different cities within Alabama. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them didn't even want to deal with me. They were like, "Nah, you're using really fancy papers, and this is weird, and it's got die cuts, and you want stickers, and, you know, it's just going to be too expensive." I had a guy,
good old Alabama.
Yeah, I had a guy tell me, like, "Oh, you know, you're using this black paper for the cover. Like, we should just use white paper, and you can print on the black." All this stuff.
So you can flood it, and it'll buckle.
And it's like something you're going to handle, like the it's going to flake off. Like the, it was difficult. But I finally found a printer rep who was like, who took me seriously and got me a good quote. And so I was like, okay, so it's going to cost $14,000 to get a run of these books printed. And I don't have that because I just graduated from college.
I'm going to go with that's still not sitting in your savings account, probably.
No, I did not have that in my savings account. So I was like, so I posted like on the site because a community had started growing on there. And I said, so I don't know how I'm going to do this because I don't know if like 100 of you want to buy books, you know, or if there's thousands of people who want to buy these books. I don't know how to gauge like how much demand is. I don't know how to raise this money to get them printed. And so, and somebody said, you should try Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know what Kickstarter is.
I was about to say, had you heard of Kickstarter at this time?
Because that was 2011. And I think Kickstarter launched in 2010. So it was.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, it was pretty new. And so I went on there and I was like, okay, I'm going to give a shot. And so I wrote up my little thing about, you know, trying to preserve the art of scorekeeping and introduce it to a new generation of fans by making, you know, this new scorebook that's easier to take with you to the ballpark and has like all these startup guides for people who aren't familiar with it. And I got accepted and I like said, okay, if I raise $10,000, you know, like I can pay for the other four out for the printing out of pocket and we'll just see how it goes. That was a mistake because if I had only raised $10,000, I would be in trouble.
Yeah. $4,000 is a lot of money.
It is. Well, and it ended up like fulfilling all the Kickstarter and stuff and everything. Like I used almost all the money that I ended up, raising like $28,000. On Kickstarter, it blew up and I did not expect that. It was a really exciting experience to kind of take a total shot in the dark and put yourself out there, and just have so many people like be gracious and support you, me as somebody that, you know, I don't even know that many baseball fans personally, especially coming from Alabama. Like, I didn't know anybody who backed the Kickstarter. Like, I was relying totally on the goodwill of strangers. And so to have that happen was really humbling, and exciting. And so that's kind of how the EFAS League got started. It started as a student project and got lucky enough to get funded through Kickstarter and did another Kickstarter since then. And so it's just this thing that I, you know, sort of sustain on the side now.
I was about to say, cause it's still going and it's, yes, you know, it's gotten popular, and that's how I first heard about you. Was actually on Makers of Sport. Adam Martin was talking about you on there, and before he even had you on as a guest, he was talking about the scorebooks and things like that, and I was curious about it. And I'm by no means am I a huge sports fan. I, you know, casually watch at best, which during football season here in Alabama that can get tough, as you well know.
Yes.
But you know, the design and that look of the ephemera, I always liked that kind of old antique look that comes along with things, and it just had that very classic look. So I started checking out, and that's how I, you know, got to know more about you and all that stuff. But I didn't realize that it had started literally as your senior project. So where did this love of baseball come from?
I don't remember a time where it wasn't a part of my childhood. I played softball growing up. My my mom's mom was a huge Braves fan. My parents were Braves fans. We went to games. I went to a game at Fulton County Stadium when I was really young before they tore it down. So it's always been in my life. And I couldn't point to one single moment where like oh, that's the moment when I fell in love with baseball, because it was just kind of always there.
It was always there.
I can't remember a time when it wasn't a part of my life.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, most people, even if they're baseball fans, don't take it to that level of deciding to do an entire project based around it, even if it's just a school project that you don't think is going to be anything. So that's why I was curious about that, because that's, you know, that's a different level of dedication. Other than just thinking, ah, this is fun, I like baseball, and you know, that's a, you've got to have interest in all aspects of the game.
It's a really great well of inspiration. Like, even just if you take like the visual aspects of it, when you think about how much of like our language and like the idioms and things that we use come from our vernacular comes from baseball, it's a really cool thing. And I just love, there's so many different, like, I love how almost all of it's codified. Like, there's records about everything. Like, you can find photos and information about, like, you know, so many people who've played the game, whether or not they're even any good at it. You know, there's players from the, you know, early 1900s, you know, you could find out every stat, you know, line that they produced, and if they had a nickname and how they got that nickname. Like, that information is probably available to you somewhere. So it's just a really cool, like, place to go to. And I don't know why I didn't think about it sooner now that I've done it. But I love having the EFAS League as like kind of a creative outlet now.
Yeah. So, you know, other than EFAS League, what are some of the other things that you do as kind of a creative outlet? I was going to ask you something else, and I'm completely blanked on what it was as a follow-up with that. But, you know, in your free time, what are you doing to bring creative juices kind of back into your head?
I try to read. I play a lot of video games. I watch so much TV. I watch way more TV than I should.
And see, you don't have kids, so, you know.
No kids.
Yeah. You don't get inundated with Nick Jr. all day and want to break the television. So.
Yes, thank God. I have friends who have kids, and they lament the lack of TV time to me very often, and just general me time. All I have is me time. So I try to Yeah. I try to get out into the outdoors as often as possible too, now that I live in Seattle, because it's beautiful here. So I like going hiking. And I do a lot of, I like to collect and catalog visual things, even if it's not necessarily design stuff. Like I'll collect pictures of like clothes and stuff that I like, or interior design ideas. And I like to, every day I have like this cycle of sites that I go to, like Dribbble and Pinterest and stuff. And I pull down things that I like, and then I loosely categorize it by like typography or book or web design. Mm-hmm. And then I put it up on a site called Dropmark and I tag it. So, you know, if it's using a specific typeface or a color or some sort of, you know, stylistic property, I like tag it with all those things. So then if I'm working on a new project, I can say, oh, I need, you know, I want to see everything that's like vintage inspired, or all the packaging that uses craft paper, and I can type it in and it'll filter out everything. And so I like doing that kind of curating.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because lately, especially the past couple of weeks, it seems like, especially on like Facebook and Instagram, you seem to have been on a run of getting lost in the details of things. And I'm just curious about, what is it about the details, the minutiae that, you know, gets to you?
I love that about, that was the goal around baseball too, is just the things that, it's like the macro, there's the macro, like entire object or entity or sport or whatever, whatever you're talking about. And then there's, I like looking at things like that and kind of pushing past that initial like emotional reaction that I have, like, oh, that thing is beautiful, and asking like, why do I think that this is beautiful? And then like, then you start to notice things like, oh, the color thread that they use on this shirt is perfect. Or look at this, you know, these little things that you might find in a design that like prove that a human has touched it, or that somebody thought about that. Like somebody thought about when you're going to open up that jacket and see that little detail, or somebody thought about, when you look at this book, you know, that the way that the emboss is going to feel on your hand, like they thought about the way that you hold the book and the way that, you know, the paper and everything's going to, you know, catch in your hand. And I try to think about those things when I do design, and I like to surround myself with as much things like that as possible to kind of like bash it over the head for me to remember to, you know, that is important, and don't forget about those things. Because it's often those little things that kind of send people over the top. Like there's nothing worse than like using a piece of software or having some kind of experience and then running into something. It's just like, did you even like try, like nobody tested this, or nobody, it's like you thought about it from an academic standpoint, like this is a thing and it needs to do X, Y, and Z, but you didn't actually like put yourself in that situation. And so I think that's details like that are sort of like, the embodiment of the amount of empathy that a designer in that situation had for the person who's going to actually end up consuming that thing later on, whether it's software or, you know, a book or clothing or a watch or whatever it is.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you there. I'm because when I design, and, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, of, you know, you like to have all of those, everything that's going to go into something before you start on it. And for me, that's when I'm designing or when I'm planning on a project, that's part of the reason I like to have that, because I can look at all of those details and start to formulate all of that stuff in my head and know where each little detail goes and if there's something missing and all of that stuff. And I'm able to build off that to be able to, it's looking at that grain of sand to know where I can get to see the entire building. So that's what I enjoy about that process and seeing those details. So that's what I appreciate when I see you posting all that stuff up, and not to sound like a stalker. One of the other things, and it kind of goes back into this details, and you mentioned it early on when you were talking about it, of, you know, limiting typefaces and things like that, is, you know, you've written an article, you've given a talk now on not limiting typefaces, almost. It's almost the antithesis of what in a corporate setting you're relegated to, of, you know, you've got two typefaces, you can use these. If you're breaking the rules, you better have a damn good reason to break those rules. And even then, it's really frowned upon. So where did that, you know, because I hadn't thought of it from that point. I had drank the Kool-Aid of two, three typefaces, you know, use different weights within those typefaces, but that's it. So it was very interesting to see someone come at that from a different perspective. So what made you kind of start getting interested in thinking about that?
I think it came, well, I think the genesis of it was that that it wasn't hammered into my, the idea that I should be limiting, or that anybody should limit the number of typefaces that they're using, wasn't really hammered home when I was in college. So outside of those first few classes where you're just learning about type and they're being very controlling about which typefaces that you use and how many, like they want to start you with like Helvetica's and Garamond's and, you know, they want to start you at the basics and get you familiar with those to teach you the different, you know, types of classifications of typefaces.
Sure.
And then like after they kind of took the training wheels off, I don't know if I ever had another a professor mention to me, like, you should consider not using, you know, outside of like, that's a bad typeface, or like, I don't think that typeface is working stylistically. I never ever got the feedback that like, you're using too many, or you should try to cut this back.
So you shouldn't use Hobo and everything?
Well, I mean, if you're using the, that new cut, that new Hobo cut that, Oh No Type Company is using, then you could probably use it, because that's actually really nice.
Yeah. I wasn't thinking about that one. I was thinking Mama Goldberg's and...
Yes. Oh, Mama Goldberg's, no. No.
Sorry, I didn't mean to make you homesick there.
I'm actually not a fan.
Really?
No.
It was always fun when I would go up to Auburn before they were everywhere, and after a hard night out to get some Mama Goldbergs. Other than that, I by no means do I think it is good food.
That's like, if I'm in Auburn and I need thank God I'm home food, it's some sort of chicken finger places. I'm gonna go to Tenda Chick or Finley's or something like that. That's what I want.
Gotcha.
But with the typefaces, so yeah, it wasn't until I left Auburn that I started kind of hearing that feedback and seeing it more and more often, and seeing a lot of people treating it like it was almost like this sort of, like you were morally, or, you know, you had some more integrity.
This unwritten law.
Yeah, you had like more integrity as a designer if you used fewer typefaces. Like, so that this like super simple like Swiss typography was the only way. And I don't say that to mean that I don't love and appreciate that aesthetic. There are a lot of people who treat multi-typeface designs as sort of the second class citizen, or that it's like a harbinger of, you know, low class design, like, you know, sure, newspaper ads or something. And I resented that, because I like typefaces, and that's one of my favorite things to waste money on is buying new typefaces. I cannot tell you how many freelance projects I've said yes to just because I want an excuse to buy a typeface.
So I need to start looking at it from that aspect.
So I'm a collector just in general. So I also like to collect typefaces, and I like to use those typefaces. So, yeah, that's always something that, so this kind of like typographic, you know, conservative, you know, thread that I had seen so often, it always kind of agitated me. And it's something that I had heard comments on a lot when people were looking at my own work and saying like, oh, you use so many typefaces and you do it so well. And it wasn't ever something that I was intentionally trying to do until recently. I have been trying to do it intentionally because of the writing, giving that talk and writing the article, and just kind of wanting to be like, okay, so this is sort of something that I've been doing intuitively. Why am I doing it? Is it a good thing that I'm doing it? And should, you know, if I'm going to give somebody else advice for how to do this and why they should do it, like, how would I convey that? So that's sort of where all of that came from.
Well, and for those who kind of aren't familiar with the article or didn't see you give a talk about it, if you'll do a much better job of explaining it. But I was basically going to say, you know, if you're going to do it, have a reason to do it. Don't just throw stuff in there to throw stuff in there.
Right. And we deal that with that a lot at Microsoft. So like I there's a section in the article that sort of explicitly talks about the experiences on Power BI.
Sure.
So Power BI is a really, Power BI is the product that I work on at Microsoft. BI stands for business intelligence. It's basically like an, like you take large sets of data from a database and you can make interactive charts, like pie charts, line charts, et cetera, from them. And it's a very complicated product. It's like Excel, but in some places even more complicated. So it's,
I would say in a lot of places more complicated.
Yes. Yeah. So it's very, there's a lot of information that needs to be on screen at once. And so we often run into these situations where it's like, I need to have like a heading, a two subheadings, and then like, you know, labels and list items. You got all these text elements. And when you're trying to do it all in one typeface, you start running out of ways that you can jazz up the type to like differentiate it and say, oh, this is a subheading versus this is, you know, a list item that you can click on versus this is a label for this like group of form controls. Like you start, there's only so many ways that you can treat SIGO. and a lot of them are like not accessible, like from an accessibility standpoint, like even if you're using like a color, which we can't really do because our color is yellow and it's impossible to read on white, even if you have good eyes. Uh-huh. If you have vision problems, it definitely doesn't pass accessibility. But even if it did, you might not be able to differentiate between like green, say dark green text versus black text versus whatever. Mm-hmm. So it logically came to, if we used a different typeface here, we would be able to really clearly be able to delineate between what type of information is serving what purpose.
Sure.
So we started introducing DIN in certain places to designate text that is not interactive. So if we have like a long list of items and we need to have like a subheading over like to divide up chunks of things, we can throw DIN in there as the subheading. And then somebody sees it. It clearly looks different than the other things. They've seen DIN before. They've never been able to click on it before. So you just kind of like start to build in this learned like knowledge. Like, okay, if I'm seeing this, it's just for labeling purposes. It's for information. I'm never going to be able to click on that thing. And just that is like a very valuable thing for users, because with the prevalence of flat design, it's clean and we all like it because, oh, look at how, you know, modern we are. We don't have like bevels on our buttons anymore. But the advantage of that old skeuomorphic design was that it was very obvious what things you clicked on and what things you didn't click on. We kind of lost that with flat design. And so I'm trying to bring back some of that recognition, like instant recognition without you having to interact with something through typefaces.
Gotcha.
So that's just like one part of, you know, that talk, and just getting into the nitty gritty of like, this isn't just about like, yeah, you know, use 8 typefaces in every design that you have. Like you've got to, you know, kind of, I usually try to start with a pair, because in most cases, like I've done single design typefaces, single designs that use one typeface, but usually I use at least 2. So start with 2. And then if you start finding, you know, if you can find repeatable patterns that require, you know, are aided by, you know, all this, it makes these like captions in my gutter of my book are at less risk of getting kind of like muddled in with the actual body copy. If they're a different typeface, then that's a great place to add another typeface. And so you can kind of like start to build these like use cases for, oh, in this instance, like it's really going to aid me and my user, my audience, my reader, whatever, however you want to classify them. If I'm using a different typeface here. So it's not just, there is obviously an aspect of fun to it. Like I have a lot of fun when I use a bunch of different typefaces, because I think it's a fun exercise and it's just sort of like playful in a way that I enjoy, but it also, you know, can have this sort of logical, like very, you know, rational thinking behind it, that it can help people actually consume your design easier.
Gotcha. So, well, and that's one of those, so you mentioned logical and rational, and then you can have fun with it. That's one thing I've kind of noticed with you is you have both sides of that, where you seem to have this very analytical side, as well as this very creative side that juxtapose each other well. And I think I would assume within your role of what you do, that makes things a lot easier.
It does. Because if I came in at Microsoft and said, we're using Den now because I feel like it, it would not fly.
Yeah. That generally doesn't fly in the corporate setting.
There are people at the company who do that, who say, all my presentations are in this typeface because I like it. And, you know, it works for them, but I want to have, you know, a firm basis on why I'm doing something like that. Because if I get dragged into a room with somebody who's more important than I am, and they're looking at me and saying, why are you doing this?
Yeah. You better have a reason to back it up.
I need to have a leg to stand on, both for me.
Cause I think it's pretty is not generally a good reason that flies with very analytical.
Pretty
people.
Is not enough. So that's good practice. And not just in like that kind of corporate environment, but for anything.
In general.
Kind of remind yourself, like, you're not just doing this because of the way that it looks.
Yeah. If you want to do it for the way that it looks, just look at George Bush's paintings. He thinks they look great.
Yes.
He's not a painter.
No.
No. Fun hobby for him. Yes. So, you know, you've done all these different things. Is there anything that you haven't had a chance to do design-wise that you've kind of always wanted to try out? I'm sure there's hundreds, but one that pops into your head.
Oh, that's a tough one. I would love to do a video game, I think, because I love games. And that's one thing that, like, I really love that I haven't got to touch much from a design standpoint. I've been working on helping redesign a fan site for Destiny called the Ishtar Collective. And hopefully that redesign launches in the next few months.
Didn't that game just come out?
Oh, that game came out in 2014. It's been a while.
See how much of a gamer I am.
relatively. It's one of those like, oh, this Destiny has a 10-year plan. Like, they're going to keep releasing DLC for it and people will always play it. It's one of those. We'll gotcha. See. I go through bursts where I'm tired of that game. But yeah, it's weird. I had like such small ambitions when I left school, so that everything that I've done is a surprise to me. And I just feel really grateful for the opportunities that I have been given. So I haven't stopped to think a lot about like, oh, I'd love to do X, Y, or Z, because I'm still kind of overwhelmed with what I've had the opportunity to do now, because I didn't think that I'd be working at a company like Microsoft, or get to work for EA Sports, or, you know, like there's all these different things. I didn't think I'd get to speak at a conference like Creative South, you know, like there's all these things that I've had the opportunity to do that I never dreamed for myself. So it's kind of, I've been asked before, like, where do you see yourself in X number of years? Or, you know, what do you want to do next? It's just like, I don't know. Like, I haven't been like picking stuff out so far. I'm just kind of, along for the ride, and the ride's been pretty fun.
Well, so I guess that's where I'm getting with that. That definitely wasn't a, you know, where do you see yourself in 10 years? Cause Lord knows I hate that question. I can never answer that question. Like, ask me where I see myself Tuesday. I might be able to tell you. But it's that what you mentioned of, you know, you didn't dream of being where you are, but were there things that you dreamed of that you would still like to do, I guess is.
I don't know, because I'm not a very ambitious, I guess. Like, I just wanted to go to grad school and come back and teach at Auburn.
Oh, wow.
That's what I wanted to do. I had no thought as to what I would do in my life, other than I'm going to go get an MFA and I'm going to come back to Auburn and I'm going to teach here. And it'll be great because I can teach web design and give them some help them build up their web design program, because that's one of the weaknesses of the program currently. And
I think that's a weakness of a lot of schools.
That was like the boomerang of go out and come back. That was it. And so everything after leaving MICA is like totally uncharted territory for me. I'm not I'm not aspirational enough. I just kind of like,
don't let your boss hear that.
I feel like things just kind of happen and I'm excited about it. But I don't like, you know,
you're happy to go with the flow.
Yes. I'm going with the flow.
Awesome. Well, maybe one day we'll have you back on and you'll have had a major dream that just revolutionized and we can break the story there. But in the meantime, I'd say going with the flow has worked out pretty well for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, like, if I could think of like a dream client, because I haven't got to do a lot of freelance, and most of the freelance that I've done hasn't, like, it's usually ends up being frustrating. Like, I'm much more well suited to a 9-to-5 job than I am to freelance, just especially if it's like freelance after a date, like a 9-to-5 job, because I try to give as much as I can to my day job. So
sure,
there's not always a lot left. So maybe that's part of the problem, is I'm thinking like, oh, I'm too tired to work for even like, even if, you know, my favorite band called up and wanted me to do something, or like they were, you know, Bungie called up and said, we want you to do the UI for the new Destiny. I would be like, oh, I'm so tired.
Well, like I said, the low aspirations have worked out for you well so far. So, I've lost my train of thought with that. So you mentioned, you know, not having a ton of ambition, that your dream was kind of to go back and teach, and you've gotten to where you are. There's got to be something driving you behind there. It can't all just be I'm good at my job and people like me. There's got to be some motivation to.
I don't know if people like me.
Well, you can't be a complete asshole and get to where you are.
I never feel like I'm 100% confident that I'm doing a good job. I'm one of those. I'm always living in constant doubt that everybody thinks that I'm a joke, and you know, that kind of a little bit of that imposter syndrome. I definitely experience that. I don't know. I just feel like I'm just trying to do the right thing in any given situation, or like do what's responsible for me. And, you know, a lot of it's, yeah. So like just trying to figure out, like, I feel like I've worked in enough places at this point now that I know like what kind of job and environment makes me feel comfortable. So when I have that, I fight for it. And I'm very hesitant to give it up. In terms of like just getting noticed in the first place, I just feel like I don't know how to describe it other than to say that I got lucky. Like, Paul didn't have to respond to that email that I wrote him about the EFIS League. If that hadn't have happened, the EFIS League would not exist. Janine Dangle, who runs a magazine out of Canada called Uppercase, featured some of my stuff when I was very early on, and that kind of got me publicity. And I remember when I spoke at Typographics last summer, and sure, I sat at the speaker's dinner. Paula Scher was there, and she sat across from me, and she was nice enough to talk to me during dinner. And she said, well, don't you think it's harder for designers now? Because when I was growing up, you know, you needed to get in print or see it, you know, you need to get into like one of the two or three major design magazines. And if you could do that, then you were just kind of set, because that was like the one funnel that everybody went to. And now there's all these designers, there's all these different ways that you can try to get your work seen. And it's just like, there's so many voices. How are you ever going to get heard?
And there's so many different realms of design now too.
Yes. And my answer to her was that I don't, as somebody who came from Auburn, Alabama, if things had been set up the way that they were, and they weren't, and the internet didn't exist, and things like Dribbble, if Dribbble didn't exist, I would have just gone back. I would have gotten my MFA and then come back, because I don't think anybody would have ever had a way to see my work.
Sure.
Because things like print magazines still exist, but, you know, I think that there's a certain there's some nepotism and other things involved with that. And
yeah, I've still yet to be featured in print magazine.
Yeah, I haven't tried. I don't pay to.
I haven't either.
I don't pay to enter in my stuff into things.
No,
I would rather just. I'd rather somebody want to show my stuff because they wanted to show it.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was good enough instead of, you know, trying to, you know, I don't know.
Oh, let me give you money so you can tell me I'm good.
Let's, you know, be a part of a livestock, you know, kind of show at a county fair. Just not as interested in that. Again, I wouldn't even prescribe it to like, oh yeah, well, you know, people like me or people think that my work is good. Cause you know, I think there are a lot of people who do better work than mine that don't get the attention. And there are a lot of people who are nicer, better people or more charismatic and everything else. I think it's a lot of it is just kind of luck, which isn't a nice thing to say when you're trying to figure out how to like give advice to somebody else, but sometimes you just have to get a little lucky.
Yeah. Well, I mean, luck plays a big deal in a lot of things though. I mean, you can be, I am sure there are thousands of actors out there who are much more talented than many of these Academy Award winners, but those Academy Award winners had the luck to get cast in their first role that got them noticed and things like that.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody else, they just didn't, or they had an off day or something like that. And yeah. I mean, the same thing applies to all sorts of different professions and all sorts of different people. So,
yeah.
But I would imagine, you know, you being an introvert, also being noticed is not exactly high on your priority list.
No, not
speaking from personal experience too.
No. It's hard being in a, yeah. It's yeah, I'm much happier when I'm alone. And that's probably been the hardest thing about the job at Microsoft is learning how to be okay with being more social at work. And just the amount of talking that I have to do, I have to talk a lot at my job now. And I'm not used to that. You know, it's not something where I just go into a cubicle and do work and then, you know, talk to people, you know, when I feel to and like going and being social at lunch. But then like when it's time to work. And you can kind of close yourself off. My job isn't like that now. You know,
no, your job is a lot of talking to people. Yes. On purpose.
It's a lot of, like, sometimes it's selling. Sometimes it's giving feedback and advice to people. Sometimes it's like helping, you know, determine direction for things moving forward. So there's, you know, it's talking to other teams, being like, you know, kind of having to take the initiative and say like, hey, we're doing this. Like, are you guys doing something like this? How are you guys handling this problem? Like just kind of trying to network and build like these connections within different teams within the company. There's a lot of that. And so that side of things. So like, I don't know how to explain like the design or aesthetic side of it and why somebody's design becomes more accepted or praised than another person's, but I've been fortunate in that area. And so the biggest thing that I've been trying to focus on personally is working on, I'm never going to change the fact that I'm an introvert, but just trying to learn how to deal with it and figure out what are my triggers? How can I avoid those triggers? What are things that I'm not comfortable with? Should I do those things more often to, you know, be more comfortable with them or, you know, figure out how to avoid those situations in the most graceful way possible?
You're describing it the way that I talk about both of my kids are on the autism spectrum. You're describing it like when I go to the doctor, how I'm like, so these are their triggers. Things like that.
Doesn't like the color red.
Is that true? You don't like the color red?
No, I don't. I don't have. I've got. I don't like.
You have no problem. I'm looking at a red painting right behind you. So.
Yes. The my thing is the color purple. I hate the color purple. Our product color on Power BI could have been purple, and I was like, "Do not make me do this, or I will be extremely unhappy."
I'm with you. Purple and orange are two colors that I just don't like.
Well, I have to like orange because I went to Auburn, but
no, I mean, I get it. I'm fine with it in that setting.
Yeah.
But as a color, I'm going to pick to use. Orange is generally not one of the forefronts.
Yeah.
So, well, cool. Well, we're getting close to our time here. You know, so you've. Being not a very ambitious person, is there anything on the horizon for you? I'm just going to pick on
you
about that.
Is that who you're going to title it? It's going to be like Bethany Heck, least ambitious designer on the planet.
Well, I feel like I have to now zero that you put that out there.
What's the key to your success? Zero ambition.
I feel like that's how I have to title it now that you put it out there.
Don't have dreams. See what happens.
Yeah, I've got your dad's email address too, so I'll send it to him. You'll get a call next Sunday. Bethany? What's going on here?
I don't know. I'm a weird mix between, like, I feel like I don't think about things enough, and then there's some things that I think about way too much.
I overthink everything, so.
Yeah. So maybe that's why I'm describing myself as not ambitious, is because my head's spinning like at 90 miles an hour about all these other things. And then I just don't have time to, like, the career stuff. I'm just like, I don't know. I just want to, like, have a job and, like, be able to pay my bills. And, you know, I'll let that just kind of happen. And then I'll, like, stress out about, like,
You're going to binge watch on Netflix next week?
Yes, which Mexican place am I going to get tacos from tonight? Like, I'll think, you know, I'll spend 30 minutes stressing out about that.
Well, now I want tacos.
You should get tacos. Tacos are always the right decision.
Yeah, I'm going red beans and rice tonight.
Good choice, so, too.
Hey, in coastal Alabama, I got to do what I got to do.
Yes. So the original question was where people can find me. Is that where we were before I went?
That's where we were getting to before we tangented out. But yeah, so where can people find more of you?
My portfolio site is heckhouse.com. I'm on Dribbble under my name, and I'm on Twitter at Ephus League. And you can also go to ephusleague.com to see any of that work.
Yeah, and we'll link to all of this stuff in the show notes, as well as to your article on Medium about the use of typefaces and how not to abuse them, still add a lot in there. Well, thank you, Bethany. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Looking forward to seeing you again, hopefully next year at Creative South.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to coming next year.
Awesome. You have a good night.
You too.
You can find out more about Bethany on Twitter, at Ephus League, or over at heckhouse.com. And be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with her. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter, at CreativeSOPod, and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, at CreativeSouthGA, or over at CreativeSouthGA.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. We're looking for sponsors. If you want to sponsor the Creative South podcast to help keep the lights on and to make the podcast even better, then email me at jason@creativesouthga.com or hit me up on Twitter at creativesopod. If you want to engage with the podcast more, check out a new podcasting app called Remarks that allows you to add notes and comments about the episodes, get feedback from other listeners, and hear from me as well. You can find it over at remarks.fm. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.